I'm introducing today Mr. Bruce Thomas. I've noted since he sat at the table and all the way in, people were speaking to him. That is because he has come home. Graduate of Oakland's University High, graduate of the University of California with the class of 28. A man of great travel, a man who has been in the fighting zone, 41 in Europe as a war correspondent, noting the commando raids about which he talked to us here in this club in 42, as well as writing about it in Harper's and elsewhere. 43 at Kiska as a correspondent. 44, Normandy beachhead on D-Day plus two. Has recently come from the Belsen trials. He has just arrived so freshly, only this morning, that I find he's still in a uniform which he tells me is the British officer's battle dress. He arrived on the Europa last week, a German ship which was a prize ship being brought to this country from Bremerhaven, and immediately started out on his tour, which will lead him during the year into every state in the Union. He will talk on what I saw in Europe. I have the pleasure, sir, of introducing you to this Commonwealth Club audience, Mr. Bruce Thomas.
Thank you, Mr. Perkins. Members of the Commonwealth Club of California, friends, in October of last year, I left Cherbourg for the short trip across the British Channel on quite a large ship, just about an 8 or 9 hour trip from Cherbourg over to Southampton. On this ship were about 4,000 of our Southern colored work troops. And also on the ship were several USO units. This story, by the way, is absolutely true, and I'll try to give it to you word for word as I saw it and heard it. Among these USO units, there was Dinah Shore, and there was Bing Crosby, and there was Spike Jones and the City Slickers, several others. And I was standing in the bridge with Miss Shore and Bing and Spike, and Miss Shore spoke up and said, "I wonder if some of you fellows would mind walking down among these colored troops with me." He said, "You know, I come from down in Tennessee, and I just kind of get homesick now and then to hear these guys talk." Well, we walked down among these colored troops, and if some of you fellows thought you won the last war, you should listen to these babies. In other words, they were taking the King's English and the President's American. They were really throwing it. They knew they had some alleged celebrities around them. They were really putting it on. We finally walked back of a couple of big bucks standing on the port side near the bow, leaning against the rail. We overheard the following conversation. The sergeant was talking to a corporal. He said, "Now you take this ocean out here. This is what they call the British Channel Ocean." He said, "Maybe you don't know, but I'm one of the world's experts in oceans. I probably know much about oceans as anybody." He said, "Now we both know because we came across the Atlantic Ocean. The Atlantic Ocean is bigger than this ocean, but this ocean is bigger than the Pacific Ocean." He said, "They have a lot of other oceans. See, they have the North Pole Ocean, the South Pole Ocean, there's a Mediterranean Ocean, a lot of other oceans." The other fellow spoke up and said, "Yeah, boy," he said, "you may know a lot about the oceans, but that stuff you're looking at out there, that's only the top of it." You know, out of the mouths of babes and other people do come these things, and truth indeed is stranger than fiction. And I thought this, and I think about it more today than I did then, that in the time allotted me, in speaking to you this afternoon, all I can do is touch the top of my subject. And I'll promise you this, that I'm not going to take anything off of a teletype. My stuff doesn't come from an unimpeachable leak. If I use that little perpendicular pronoun I too much, please just consider the source. I'm not going to pull my punches this afternoon. I'm going to try to, I wished I could, pull a shutter across my mind and let you look in. I've just come from that part of the world where the roof is caved in. And I say caved in, I mean that literally. You know, the great good book tells us that there are two ways of judging or knowing a person. One says, by their deeds shall ye know them. And the other, as a man thinketh in his heart, so is he. We were told a long time ago that the best way of knowing about any phenomenon of history is to check the reasons why, find out why a people act like they act and think like they think and talk like they talk and do as they do. And that's known as the genetic approach to history. I'd like to take you back to 1900 years ago when Tacitus, the great Roman historian, said of the Alemanni, the original Germans, that they will never accomplish by agriculture or industry or the peaceful arts anything that they can accomplish by blood or violence. Nowhere can you find in the German vocabulary the word for fair play. You cannot find in the German language the word for gentleman. Think that over for a moment, please. In 1577, Jacob Katz, a Dutch poet, and quite a guy in his time, gave us this little poem. This was 1577. When the German is poor and down, he's the humblest man in town. But when he rises and holds the rod, he smites his fellow man and God. Goethe, in 1786, said that the Prussian is by nature cruel, and civilization will only make him ferocious. You might say that the first edition of Mein Kampf was written by Fichte, the German philosopher. And he said that the only great race left in the world are the Germans. The other nations have passed their zenith and are declining. The future, therefore, belongs to the Germans, who must be recognized as world leaders. Well, this was back in 1807. And he went on to prove these things with a perversion of facts of history that probably Dr. Goebbels himself even envied. Then we go to Friedrich Nietzsche, the German philosopher. And he called Christianity that slave morality of the many weak, who by craving pity and sympathy and charity cripple the potentiality of the strong. In Nietzsche's theory, the strongest are the best, and he exalted the ugly and the brutal and the unscrupulous. General Ludendorff, get closer to our modern times, let's say, took the same attitude when he said that Christianity was bad for the German Herrenvolk. And Hitler went on to say that Christianity is always unwanted. Now, Hitler was no accident. The whole of the 19th century in Germany was a highly organized and conscious preparation for the advent of the Hitler regime. The forces and elements in Germany that raised Hitler to power and maintained him was the same perfidious statescraft that we've had through Bismarck and through the Kaisers and the warlords. You know, I think it would do 130 million Americans a lot of good to pull out their copies or get a copy of Mein Kampf. It's good reading today. It reads like a fairy story. You know, these babies, they don't telegraph their punches. They send them by slow mail. And everything that Hitler said he was going to do, he nearly did, and he came very close to us. And a few of us, if I might say, on the inside, and I've been talking to Nat Pieper about it here, know how close we came to getting a kick in the teeth on several occasions. Hitler said in Mein Kampf, and he wrote this back in 1933, that I shall eradicate thousands of years of human domestication. I want to see again in the eyes of youth the gleam of the beast of prey. A youth will grow up before which mankind will shrink. Well, we've met him and we haven't shrunk. Last year in the Reader's Digest, there was a very fine article, and it'll bear a little repetition. And many of you, without a doubt, have heard the quote several times. One of them had to deal with this man, Stupnagel. I've always liked that name, by the way. He was the military governor of Paris in that area. And he made this statement. This was back in 1944, just last year. That what does a provisional defeat matter to us if we have been able to destroy so much manpower and material in neighboring territories that we have obtained an economic and numerical superiority greater than before 1939. The conquest of the world will require numerous stages. But the essential is that the end of each stage brings us an economic and industrial potential greater than our enemies. With the war booty which we have accumulated, with the enfeebling of two generations of the manpower of our neighbors, and with the destruction of their industry, we shall be better placed to conquer 25 years from now than we were in 1939. And then we listened to Gerd von Rundstedt, who was Hitler's number one man against invasion, the supreme commander. And he issued these instructions to the War Academy in Berlin. The destruction, now not the conquest, but the destruction of neighboring peoples and their riches are indispensable to our victory. One of the greatest mistakes we made in 1918 was to spare the civil life of enemy countries. For it is necessary for us Germans to be at least double the number of peoples in contiguous countries. We are therefore obliged to destroy at least a third of their inhabitants. The only means is organized underfeeding, which in this case is better than machine guns. Well, I've been asked this question a number of times. Well, aren't there any good Germans? Of course there are good Germans. What good is a good German going to do in Germany if he can't do any good? We found over 90,000 Germans in the concentration camps. Over 90,000 Germans who've been put there by the Nazis. How many other scores of thousands had been liquidated, we don't know. We probably never will know. Remember this, please, that from 1848 to 1890, 4 million Germans came to this country, disgusted with the type of conditioning which was going on among those people at that time, conditioning for just this type of thing. Check your history. The Germans have overrun Europe 5 times in the last 70 years, and they've come closer to their mark every time. In other words, world conquest is just a matter of time, and we're going to get our teeth kicked out unless we recognize that 100%. Over 4 million Germans migrated to this country from 1848 to 1890. Remember that Wendell Willkie family came over here in 1848. Those people produced Admiral Nimitz and General Eisenhower and General Spatz. They make great citizens if you assimilate them in time. But you also had in this country somewhere between 250 and 300,000 of these licensed swine who call themselves Bundes. And if we don't look out, we're going to have them in our hair again. They're going to creep out like little white things from under rocks. Gentlemen, I'm pleading with you as an audience. I'm going to plead with all of my audiences before whom I speak this year to get tough and stay tough. We've got to look out for these peace at any price, religious pacifists. I call them peace criminals. We've got to look out for these 2x4 preachers, and there's thousands of them throughout the country, who don't know the difference between good and bad because they've never been bad. They have no standard of comparison. We've got to look out for these little sanctimonious bums who are telling us to turn the other cheek, that all Germans are good Germans and all Japs are good Japs. We just got them wrong. Well, I'll promise you this. If we turn the other cheek, we're going to get our heads knocked off. If you want to find out, if you want to talk to men of God who have been there, because you see, there have been two sides, rather two ends to this war club of ours. There's been the bloody end, the wet end. We haven't had to worry about that. That boy you're thinking about right now, son or brother, whoever he may be, a lot of you fellas in this audience, you took good care of that end of the war club, but there was the dry end of the war club. which was a civilian's job and the job of the chaplain. And I've talked to these chaplains by the hundreds, and I mean hundreds literally, because I was picking their brains. I wanted to get their viewpoint. And every single chaplain, every single man of God I've talked to has told me that we've got to give these babies a tough piece. Not that there aren't plenty of preachers in this country who agree with these chaplains, but we've got to look out for these little traitors and semi-traitors and peace criminals. We've got to look out for the Gerald L. Smiths. We've got to look out for the Hearst and the McCormicks. By the way, I don't work for Hearst, thank God. In other words, if I want to say something like this, I'm not afraid of being taken off the payroll tomorrow. We've got to look out for the Fishes. We've got to look out for the Father Coghlans. We've got to look out for these, and I use the word traitor here, American firsters. We've got to look out for these hyphenated groups who are springing up. Or we're going to have a third world war in 20 to 25 years from now. As I say, these Germans do not telegraph their punches. They send their word to you by slow mail and you don't recognize it. I recall, but very recently, talking to a full colonel, a former full colonel in the Luftwaffe, a nice-looking guy. He was about 32 or 33. You talk to him about normal things. He's the type of fellow you'd like to play poker with, maybe, or go fishing with. But he'd taught geopolitics in Germany prior to the war, and he had all of his answers cold. And when I finished with him, a British public relations man standing next to me, said, "Thomas, if the guy had talked to you for another 10 or 15 minutes, he probably would have made a Nazi out of you." Well, he went on to say that you have not won the World War yet. He had the stuff absolutely cold, as I say. He said, "Yes, you beat us in North Africa. You came in Normandy. You hit the Rhine and you bounce back." Well, we know how we bounce back there, and we know how close some of us do anyway. We came to getting our teeth kicked out on several occasions. But he went on to say that we have from 9 to 11 million German boys from the ages of anywhere from 7 to 8 who already know that their fathers were right, on up to 16. He went on to say that you wait 15, 20, maybe 25 or 30 years from now, we will prove to you that we are right. We have made two great mistakes. We now know what they are. America has been the arsenal, and we will get you first next time. Well, you kind of want to do this to a guy like that, but there's a war going on, and you just don't do it. 2 weeks ago last Sunday, I was in the officers' club in The Hague in Holland. And I had met on several occasions a certain British captain in charge of some of their secret work in that part of the world. There were still, in fact, there's uncovering certain little plots going on. It might interest some of you to know that between The Hague and the coast, there are still thousands of Germans in those sand dunes. You men who have been in that part of the world know of the hundreds of square miles of sand dunes. And there are miles and miles, tens of miles of tunnels in that part of the world, and several thousands of Germans in uniform with tons of supplies and ammunition are still living there, and they come out in small bands every night. Well, of course, we're clearing them out squad by squad and man by man, but it's going to take a number of months before we get the last of them out. Well, this particular chap was handling that work there. He knew that I was leaving the next morning, which is a Monday, about 9 o'clock, for Antwerp. He knew that I had my own driver in a Jeep, and he asked if he might ride with me. I was glad to have somebody go down with me because I was coming back that same evening. I picked him up about 9:30, quarter to 10, and we went over to commissary PX and picked up some K rations. About 1:30, quarter to 2 in the afternoon, we stopped for luncheon in a typical Belgian village. And when I say the roof is caved in, I mean that literally. Thousands of cities, and that 1,000 miles of beachhead from the north coast of Spain to the north coast of Norway have been absolutely ruined. Here was a typical case. City of probably, little town rather, about 1,500 people. Originally now only 200 or 300 people are living there, only 8 or 10, 15 houses still standing. We got out of our Jeep, eat our K rations, we went over to the combination drugstore, grocery, saddle shop, and so on and so forth, and bought a bottle of very bad early 1945 Vin Rouge for about 15 or 20 cents, but the best you could get to wash down this alleged food. And we decided to take a little walk. Any place you walked in either direction, northeast, south, or west, You get the fields beyond this town. Oh, we walked out towards the west, and just as we came to the edge of this little village, we saw a man cutting grass with a sickle. Well, this British captain spoke all of the languages of the Low Country. He spoke a very good Flemish, understood it, and read it, and write it, and the following conversation was translated to me later on, but I got the documentary evidence of this story, and again, truth is stranger than fiction. We walked up to this man, and the captain started in on a conversation. He just started, and he noticed that he was cutting grass around a marble slab, and on this slab was the name of a party, born January 8, 1929. Well, my son, Bruce Jr., was born on January 8, 1929. And there's a double hook to this story, gentlemen. And died January 8, 1945. On the boy's 16th birthday. Well, my boy will be 17 on January 8, 1946. I didn't say anything to the captain at the time. The captain engaged this old gentleman into a conversation. I got the part of it. And he asked him to tell him the story of this grave, why he was taking such good care of it, why all the flowers, because there was a profusion of flowers around the grave, why so much the way of flowers was there. And here's the story. He said in the middle of December of last year, and this happened about once a month, the storm trooping came into town, and they usually picked out one individual, and they picked out this boy because he was the youngest of the youngest. The men in town, the rest of them had been put into concentration camps and sent into slave labor in Germany. They thought that he was probably of the underground or knew something about it, and they blamed him for being a terrorist. The old man said, well, maybe he'd done his duty, who didn't? But they could find nothing on him. They could find nothing in his home. They took him to their headquarters, and they gave him what they call the water treatment, and thousands, probably scores of thousands of peoples of Europe know what the water treatment is. They simply fill a large tub, a bathtub full of either very hot or very cold water, doesn't matter which. They tie their hands and their feet together and they pull their feet out, submerge their heads, and they keep them there anywhere from a minute and a half to 2 minutes till they're nearly drowned. Then they pull them out, they bat them around, get the waters out of their lungs and start questioning them. The answers aren't right, they simply put them in again. Well, the boy refused to talk. It went on 8, 9, 10, a dozen times. He lost count. It took about an hour and a half, and he was close to death on each one of these occasions, probably another quarter or a half minute. He would have drowned. They took him out and they tied his hands behind him. They hung him over a pillar in the room. And the Germans ran and took, you might say, dives, like they were tackling a chap, around the ankles. And both shoulders were broken. Well, this went on for 6 or 7 days. On the 9th or the 10th day, I forget which now, and the boy was nothing more or less than a bag of bones. They simply took him home. He'd refused to talk. They simply took him home and threw him against the front door. The end of about 14 days, due to the best of nursing and the fact that the townspeople had brought in all kinds of food, the boy was up on his feet again and learning how to walk. And the Germans came back on about the 15th day. It was very clever of them. And they put him through 3 more days of the same type of torture, but still he didn't talk. And on the 4th night, they hung him by his heels from these same rafters with his head down. The Germans left in the middle of the night, and they found the boy the next morning. The body was still warm, but the boy was dead. With that, the old Belgian started to walk away, and the captain called him back. And he said, listen, old man, he said, I don't doubt your story. He says, we know many such stories. But he said, why do you feel so sure? What's the reason? Why are you so sure about this? He said, I know had it been me, I would have cursed my captors. The old man had told him, by the way, that the boy's last words had been a prayer to his God. And he asked him why he was so sure about this. The old man simply said, I know, for he was my son. Well, gentlemen, that could have happened to me. This boy was born on the same day, thousands of miles away, when my boy was born. Directly across from the main station, the depot, there in The Hague, when the Germans were retreating, for absolutely no reason at all, they picked 150 boys up to the age of 15 or 16. They couldn't find any others because they'd been taken into Germany in slave labor. Simply lined them up in front of the central station there in The Hague and machine gunned them. Well, you get beyond the point of conversation on these things when you see the results, when you get the documentary evidence, when you talk to people and get the proof of this. You only wish to God that the people of America, 130 million of you, could go over there and just see what had happened. And I'll promise you this, if you were there, you'd have an altogether different mental viewpoint. On the day that I arrived in The Hague a couple of months ago, and I've mentioned The Hague several times because I quartered out of The Hague this last time because it was just a matter of a couple of hours into Western Germany. I could go down to Belgium and so forth, and I'd be gone sometimes for a week or 10 days. And the very day that I was there, I met this captain I talked to you about a moment ago, and he asked me to go out in the country with him to visit a friend of his who was ahead of the underground in the district known as Lycée, about 40 or 50 kilometers north of The Hague. And I met this young chap, a Count von Doren was his name, a chap only about 24 or 25 years of age. They lived in a lovely old home, an old castle, you might say, which had been, of course, torn down by the Germans when the Germans practiced their scorched earth policy. They were living in the stables now, but the kitchen garden around the old home was still intact. And the first of the apples were coming out. They had none of their tulips. They'd eaten the tulips. You see the tulip in the same family as the onions, and you actually can take a tulip bulb and dig it out and fry it. They're edible, all right. You can eat them. The great welts and pimples and sores appear in the face and all over the body. But, correctly, all the tulips in that part of the world have been eaten because they had nothing else to eat. I was sitting there munching an apple in the garden. There were several of us sitting in chairs on this lovely Sunday afternoon. And this young Dutchman spoke up and he says, "You like the apple?" I said, "Yes." I said, "It's very sweet and very nice." He said, "Well, it should be good because we have 8 apple trees here. And under each tree are 3 Germans. They make very good manure." This chap was ahead of the underground for the last 2 years. He told me a story, and to establish the proof of the story, I had him take off his shoes. And he showed me all along the soles where the feet had been cut by doctors to remove the bones, because day in, day out, month in, month out, for 6 months, the treatment they gave him was the jumping on his feet by their hobnail boots to get information out of him, which is a very painful treatment, I promise you, from what I saw. And this chap is just hobbling around, he'll be a cripple for the rest of his life. But he told me a story which I thought was rather interesting. Many, many hundreds of Germans were killed by the Dutch underground. They were very clever in the way they worked. In fact, as I might say in passing here, that the Poles have had a terrific treatment. So the French, the Belgians, the Danes, the Norwegians, but I'll go on record, and I think it can be definitely established, the Dutch, without a question, received the roughest treatment of all. The Germans said, "We're going to only leave their eyes, and we're going to leave their eyes to cry with," and they really did just that. This chap told me, he said, "In my experience," he says, "I've only met one good German, and it happened about a year and a half ago. I was coming home one evening, about 9:30 or 10 o'clock, it was quite dark. And he said that the curfew was at 6 o'clock. We had to be home, but I was out doing a little work that evening. And I was on my bicycle because I had several miles to go, and I was coming along the footpath, along the road." And he said every once in a while, of course, I had to duck into the bushes as cars went by. So I was about a quarter mile from home, and all of a sudden the lights of a car flashed on me, a car parked in the road. I didn't see it. So I was right on this car. And he said there was a German colonel in the car. He said the man had a certain amount, he says, you say in America, guts. Well, I'll call it intestinal fortitude. He says he had his guts. He said he came out because he wanted to take me alone. They suspected me. They'd had me in prison camp once for 6 months and several times over a weekend, and the guy was pretty well battered. A lobe of his ear was gone and so forth. I didn't know the story until he told me how that had happened. He says, I held up my hands, but he says, my hands went up. He said, I had my overcoat over my right hand, and there was a pistol in my hand. He said, I was riding along in the bicycle in that way. He says, I held my coat in my hand. He said, all I had to do was throw the coat off and shoot this chap. He says, I couldn't very well do it because the lights are on me, and I didn't know who was in the car. And he said, this colonel spoke up, and he says, you are Karl von Doren, Count von Doren. He said, I lied. He said, now, wait a minute. He says, I know you are. He says, what are you doing out after curfew? Well, he said, I had my alibi. There was a sick friend. I was out to see a sick friend. I knew I was wrong. I was not supposed to be out after curfew, but of course he was out to do another job. And he says, I walked closer to this man. And he says, don't lie. He says, we know you are the members of the underground. And he produced proof. Well, he says, I knew I was going to be shot. There was only one thing to do. And he says, I started to berate this man. I told him that he was not a sportsman. And he said he proved that he was. He was a good sportsman. He had a gun across his knee. And I had my pistol in my hand. He said, all right. He says, you can get your gun. He said he was holding on to it. Just as quickly as I can throw my overcoat off, he says, I have a pistol in my hand. He says, at the end of three, let's both shoot. Well, he says, this is what left of my ear, but he says, I got him through the eyes. He was a gentleman. He played the game. I was in a little town about 4 miles east of Apeldoorn, Germany, Apeldoorn, Holland, rather, a number of weeks ago, a town of about 6,000 people. During the early part of the war, two German soldiers had been killed in a brawl with Dutch peasants. They'd insulted these men, they'd kicked them around, but the Germans had been killed. In retaliation, the SS troopman came into the town the next day and at random picked the first 2,000 men. The fact is, they picked the first 2,000 men over 18 and took them into Germany as slave labor. This, by the way, was in the early part of 1941. Don't ever get the idea, gentlemen, that these atrocities over there happened only in 44, 43. We only heard about them then. The Germans didn't know what was going on in Belgium. The Dutch had no idea, whether the Dutch had no idea what was going on in Belgium or in Norway. There was a strict censorship. They had no idea what was going on in the world for years. They took these 2,000 men from 18 on up into Germany. In retaliation, that was their excuse for the killing of these two German officers. We liberated all the people from Belsen. I was in Belsen during the first 2 days of the Belsen trials. And not a bit of that has been colored, I promise you. In fact, this is a great deal worse than most of us have any idea. To date, only 4 of those original 2,000 men have returned to that town, and they had every opportunity to in the last number of months. And I interviewed 3 of the 4 men. Oh, I could go on and on and on and tell you these stories. But again, gentlemen, I'm pleading with you to give these babies a tough peace. Give them the type of peace that our chaplains have asked to give them. The lovely part of it is you don't have to be cruel in giving them a tough peace. But if it's a matter of policing from 25, 50, 100 years, it'll be well worth the effort. It'll be well worth any expense which many people are now squawking about. In other words, instead of the hundreds of millions of year, hundreds of billions, actually, going into the matter of 2 or 3 billions a year, without a question, if we do police, will stop the possibility of a World War III. Something strikes pretty close to home in reviewing this particular story, and this thing happened to me in, again, October of last year and coming back from Germany. I was to come back over the same territory and come down to Omaha and Utah beachhead, there above the Normandy beachheads where the greatest invasion of all time took place in June 6th of 1944, and I was for the first time to go into one of our large cemeteries, and I'd heard, as had you and the people of England, the people of the world, that we had lost somewhere between 700 or 800 of our men on that morning of the June 6th of 44, and that greatest invasion of all time. YOWY didn't give us that bit of information, as they gave us so much misinformation all during the war, and I think to the detriment of the effort. Why, I don't know. But we now know that somewhere between 13 and 14,000 boys were lost on that morning. In other words, the pessimists were wrong and the optimists were right. Well, I happened to be with a young Lieutenant J.G., because this is what we call an NOIC beachhead, a Naval Officer in Charge beachhead, and the boy was from San Francisco by coincidence. And he was given to me as my liaison officer. And I walked through these graves with him. I expect to see, as I say, 800 or 900 white crosses, and I saw about 200 acres of solid crosses there, and I'll tell you, had I been alone, I probably would have broken down and cried like a kid, because you take these things personally. And on that afternoon with this boy, I was to do something. To this day, I don't know why. I've checked my mental palpitations. I can't remember the reason for it. Probably fate, call it what you wish. I picked up a stone, and I threw it along a path. The stone rolled some 30 or 40 feet and landed alongside of a grave and rolled up and hit alongside of a cross. We walked to where the stone stopped rolling, and the graves were in plots of 25 long and 12 wide. And I gave this chap a pencil and a piece of paper and asked him to jot the names and the addresses down as I read them off to him, the unit numbers and so forth, because in the back of each cross was a dog tag nailed on the cross. And the very first name he read off to me, and I want to qualify this story by telling you that I have the permission of the father of this boy to tell this story. In fact, he's been with me on an occasion where I told this story before another Greek group. The very first name that he read off to me was Carl W. So-and-so, the last name doesn't make any difference, of 3000 Claremont Avenue, Berkeley, California. The boy lived very close to me, lived there for quite some time. I'd met him on several occasions before the war. And it so happens when I came back and told the boy's father and his wife that I'd visited the grave, naturally it was a pretty tough thing to do, but they were quite happy to meet somebody who had found the last resting place of the son and the husband. They had not heard up to that time where he was. Well, the very next boy came from a little town in northern New Jersey. And the next boy came from Detroit, Michigan. And the next boy came from West Virginia. And the next boy from Afton, Oklahoma. And the next boy from South Carolina. The next two boys came from northern New York State, in two little towns about 5 miles apart. Kids about the same age. They probably didn't even know each other, as one had been shot out of the air, another came in on a landing craft. Oh, to go on and make that long story short. These 12 boys came from 11 states. Oh, I know if the rock had probably rolled to another group of graves, they probably all would have come from California, New York, I don't know. But the average age of these boys was a little over 20. I've had the permission to tell this story and to visit the parents and tell them exactly what I've seen there. And I've contacted so far over a period of months and have seen 10 of the 12 fathers or mothers or wives of these boys. And I found that 6 of the 10 boys' fathers were over there last time. All of them came back. But gentlemen, that still isn't the story. In those 12 graves were 2 Jewish boys and 4 Catholics and 6 Protestants. And there's the story. These kids rib each other. This is a touch of levity in here, I might say, but it's right to the point. We have a sense of humor which no other people have. These kids kid each other. They're loyal to their hometown and their state. And I happened to be in the Quonset hut in England last year with my nephew, my sister's son, who was a Toggle Air bomber and a bomber. I was going up next day with this particular group on a flight, on a mission. And it so happens that boy's grandfather is in the audience today, right here close to me. And the kid was kind of cocky and proud of the fact that his Uncle Brucey was there and going up with him on this mission. He said, "Uncle Brucey, please don't go." He said, it's pretty tough stuff, but they were going to do some bombing over Belgium and Holland the next day, and I wanted to go. He called in 3 or 4 other crews in this Quonset hut, and the kids were kind of putting it on for me that night. I thought they were going to get into fisticuffs a few times, but they didn't. And finally, a kid from Brooklyn got into an argument with a kid from Texas, and the kid from Brooklyn was a little bit smarter than the kid from Texas. This is probably the way it should be. And he said, "You know, Tex," he said, "maybe you're right, maybe I'm right, I don't know." He said, "Maybe if you come to Brooklyn," he said, "maybe you like my town better than your town, I don't know." He says, "I'd take you down, I'd show you Prospect Park, that's a great park." He said, "I'd show you the bums, we'd get play ball, we'd go down, we'd go to Coney Island." He said, "It's a great town, only a nickel, you can go over to New York anytime you want it." But he said, "Maybe if I came to Texas, maybe that's the best place, I don't know." He says, "There's one thing about us Americans, we're loyal, huh?" He said, "We're not like these Jerrys." He said, "Maybe someday, you can't tell." He said, "Maybe someday we'll be sticking our hand out like this, but by the end of the first day, we'd come back thumbing our nose at it, wouldn't we, huh?" Well, gentlemen, these kids rib each other. They kid each other. They seem to live on it. But whether they're black or white or brown, and I've watched our Nisei, and I've been to Japan on a number of occasions, and I don't like the Japanese. I know them pretty well. I've gone a little deep into their genetic history, may I say. I simply don't like them. I'm biased. I know them. But our Nisi have done a terrific job of war. Our colored troops have done just about as twice as good a job of war as the average person who don't like them would not have them do. Whether these boys are black or white or brown, whether they're Jews or Catholic or Protestant, doesn't cut into the picture. Here were these kids, thousands of miles away from home, buried in the same place, and they didn't ask for it. And if there's anything I'm trying to get over today, oh, I wish that by the thousands, Americans, before they cover up Belsen, and before they cover up these other horror camps, could go over there and see for their own eyes. I've had people already say, oh, I know, that stuff was manufactured in Hollywood. You haven't seen the pictures yet. They dare not show you the pictures, the actual pictures of what took place over there. I'm a little bit, oh, may I say, proud of this little closing story of mine. Cocky might even be the word. A few months ago, I was asked to take a tour of our tougher hospitals throughout the East and Middle West. And I went into our blind hospital, which there were about 2,000 boys, anywhere from one eye out to total blindness, about 1,000 of them totally blind, in the town of Butler, Pennsylvania, about 20 miles north of Pittsburgh. I was to talk to about 1,100 or 1,200 of these boys who would get into their auditorium. I was giving them a background of history and war and a few other things. Most of the kids could tell me in a minute, but I could tell them in a month about actual warfare, but I was going into the causes and reasons and so on and so forth. And I was asked later to go upstairs and meet a boy who had been shot through the eyes and shot through the hips down in Guadalcanal, a kid just 19. And the nurse had a reason for it, because when I got up there, she asked if he would mind showing me a poem which he had written. Well, I think this kid had had a touch of genius, because he'd never written anything before in his life. He was just 19. And over a period of about 2 months, he dictated this poem to his nurse, word by word, line by line. When I read it, I'll tell you, the tears came to my eyes. I saw to it the next day that this poem was published in a Pittsburgh paper, been published in the Saturday Evening Post, a number of magazines and defense plants. Maybe some of you have heard it. And the boy called it A Weary Fighter. So you're sick of the way that the country is run. And you're sick of the way that rationing is done. And you're sick of standing around in line. You're sick to say, well, that's just fine. I'm sick, but I'm sick of the sun, and I'm sick of the heat. And I'm sick of the feel of my aching feet. And I'm sick of the mud and the jungle flies, and I'm sick of the stench when the night mist rises. And I'm sick of the sirens wailing and shriek, and I'm sick of the groans of the wounded and weak. And I'm sick of the sound of the bombers dive, and I'm sick of seeing the dead alive. And I'm sick of the roar and the noise and the din, and I'm sick of taste of food from a tin. And I'm sick of slaughter, I'm sick to my soul, and I'm sick of playing a killer's role. And I'm sick of blood and death and smell, and I'm even sick of myself as well. But I'm sicker still of a tyrant's rule, in conquered lands with a wild beast drool. And I'm cured damn quick when I think of the day when all of this hell will be out of the way. When none of this mess will have been in vain, and the lights of the world will blaze again. And things will be as they were before, and kids will laugh in the streets once more. And the Axis flag will be dipped and furled, and God looks down on a peaceful world. Thank you.